The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate. Dongshan gets 60 blows, the main case. When Dongshan came to have an interview with Master Yunmen, Yunmen asked, "Where have you been recently?" "At Jatu, Master," Dongshan replied. "Where did you stay during the last training period?" "At Paozu Monastery in Hunan," replied Dongshan. "When did you leave there?" "On the 25th of August," Dongshan answered. Yunmen exclaimed, "I give you 60 blows with my stick." The next day, Dongshan came up again and asked the master, "Yesterday you gave me 60 blows with your stick. I don't know where my fault was." Yunmen cried out, "You rice bag, have you been prowling around like that, now south of the lake, next west of the river?" At this, Dongshan was enlightened. Woman's commentary. If Yunmen at that time, by giving Dongshan the fodder of the truth, had awakened him to the vivid, dynamic Zen life, then Yunmen's school would not have declined. In the sea of yes and no, Dongshan struggled all through the night. When the day broke and he came to see the master again, Yunmen helped him break through. Though Dongshan was immediately enlightened, he was not bright enough. Let me ask you, should Dongshan be struck or not? If you say he should be struck, then trees and grasses and everything should be struck. If you say he should not be struck, then Yunmen is telling a falsehood. If you can be clear on this point, you and Dongshan will breathe together. In the poem, a lion trains its cubs this way. If they walk ahead, it prods them and quickly dodges. Against his will, Dongshan had to be struck again. The first arrow only nicked him, but the second one went deep. So we're concluding an introductory retreat this morning. And the koan is a rather unique form of training in the Buddhist tradition, really in the world of spiritual training. There are certainly religious traditions, spiritual traditions, in which there are dialogues and interchanges between a teacher and a student that are not appearing on the ordinary plane, that are more based in a mystical understanding of things, that are there to try and not so much educate the student, but precipitate some shift in their consciousness. And the koans certainly have that element. What's some of the unique aspects of the koan is that they're taken in and used as meditation practices. So they, as they evolved in the history of the Chan tradition, they were taken up and incorporated into a meditative process in a very particular way, because they're using language, and language has meaning, and we get caught up in those things easily and just become sort of, mired in our intellectual, conceptual-making mind. And so for the student that takes in the question that the koan is presenting, they take in those words. Sometimes it's words, it's an action, depends on what the koan is, but they don't let their mind become conceptual. They use the concentration of their mind to bring that very clear, bright, penetrating power of the mind that we all possess, that is cultivated in meditation, to see deeply into or inquire deeply into the koan in such a way that they're not thinking about it. And that, in a way, can't be taught. The student of the koan has to learn how to do that. They have to discover how to do that themselves. And in those moments when the mind becomes unified, where the student in the koan that is no longer subject and object, it's no longer I am sitting with this, I am inquiring, merge, they, in a sense, enter into the heart of the koan. They enter into the reality of the koan. And in that moment, there's a potential for it to be realized, for the mind to shift and experience something directly. And so this koan is an example of such a moment that was happening between a teacher and a student, where there was a dialogue on the spot that precipitated that shift for this student, Dongshan. And this Dongshan is not the Dongshan of our lineage. This one, this Dongshan came later in the 10th century. He was a student of Yunmen's and a successor of Yunmen's. And he was a very sincere student. You can see that in the koan. He traveled many miles in his studies, as he gives evidence to, seeking out teachers, seeking out teachings. And such traveling at that time was very often not easy, could be very dangerous, actually, and was an expression of sort of a result of the student's deep yearning to study, to practice, to encounter a teacher, to realize their mind. So in this dialogue, Yunmen asks this simple question: where have you been? Where did you last train? When did you leave there? A simple exchange, simple questions, honest answers. Shibayama, who commented on this, said, this where have you been recently may refer to a place, but it also asks about one's inner sense, one's deeper understanding. And so in that way, these koans, these questions, these teachers are often speaking on multiple levels. And they're looking to see where does the student respond from? In other words, how narrow or broad is their world, is their mind? From within a fixed sense of self, I'm over here, you're over there. From your perspective, you're here and I'm over there, right? I come and go. We have all come here. Many of you came here this morning or came here on Friday. You'll return. And so the same questions could be asked. Where have you been recently? When did you leave there? Yunmen would have encountered many, many such students, had many such dialogues. And here he's encountering a way-seeking student, a person seeking the way. And in Buddha Dharma, you know, as I mentioned on Friday night, the Buddha didn't talk about religion. That wasn't a notion that he took up. He said, this is a path. And that's a very particular thing. It's a very important thing. It's not an idea. It's not an institution. It's something that we do. It's a walking thing. It's a way of traveling, you could say. And when we travel, we move from one step and the next. There's an image in our tradition of crossing over a shore from one shore to the other. The shore and the river is sort of the river of samsara, all of the craziness and the madness of the world and of our lives. And we want to cross over to the other shore, to the shore of enlightenment. And what we realize after that arduous journey is that when we finally arrive at the other shores, we actually haven't taken a single step. We haven't moved anywhere. We were always in exactly the right place. And so in the Buddha Dharma, being on a path, though, doesn't just mean doing meditation or having goals or hopes or dreams, setting intentions. It's not just about wanting something and working towards its goal. Those can all be fine. In a way, you could say they're all elements of this practice. But in Buddhism, the path means the Eightfold Path. It's particular. I spoke about that. It's a path of engaging our mind, our body, our everything. Because in our everything, we are creating our world. We are creating heaven and hell. And so the Buddha said, we can do that in a way that continues to create heaven and hell and hope for a better balance. Or we can use those very same powers, you could say, that we have, understanding, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration. in a way that comes into enlightenment, not only brings us to enlightenment, but brings it into alignment with enlightenment, with the real nature of things. That's why we say it's a path of peace. It's not just a path of not creating harm and of creating peace, but it's a path of being in a state of peace, because that's our natural state. In the first of the ox herding pictures that you see downstairs, which is an ancient Chan depiction of the path, the first verse that accompanies that is, "In the pasture of the world, I endlessly push aside the tall grasses in search of the true self. Following unnamed rivers, lost upon the interpenetrating paths of distant mountains, my strength failing, my vitality exhausted, I cannot find it. I only hear the locusts chirping through the forest at night." And that gives us a sense of the journey, traveling through these tall grasses. It's hard to see, it's hard to get a bearing, it's hard to have a sense of, am I moving in the right direction? Am I moving in circles? Am I going backwards? Following unnamed rivers, even though people have been walking this path for 2,500 years, and we are the most fortunate recipients of those teachings and the history and the affirmation generation after generation that this path is real. When we step into that, we're stepping into it for the first time. So in a way, we're rediscovering, recreating ourselves what has been done over and over by countless others before us, following unnamed rivers. And so even though the path is laid out, in a sense, every step is in unnamed territory, uncharted waters. My strength failing, my vitality exhausted, I cannot find it. And so the teachings about the importance of continuing, of persevering, of just taking another step, taking another breath. The Buddha was very clear in laying out this path. We have to practice our negative patterns, the habitual ways of thinking and feeling and acting that cause harm for ourselves and others. We need to deal with the restlessness of our mind. That's why the first thing that happens when you came here on Friday night was we gave you a little food, gave you some sheets, and then taught you meditation. The most important thing, and we really can't underestimate or underpoint to the importance of the meditation in this path of Buddha Dharma. And we think of it in these ways. We think of it in terms of developing our mindfulness and concentration and dealing with our distractedness and difficult emotions. And all of that is essential. And all of that is about calming those difficult tendencies that we have and those repetitive, impulsive actions, the ways we have of reacting to things and so on. But in that calming, the doors of our mind open. That which is always present, but as the Buddha said, is subtle and difficult to see, becomes more apparent, and we make contact. And that's ultimately not only what's transformative, but we realize is what's liberating. In a sense, practicing any of the Eightfold Path, any one of those would be good, is good. But they all work together, and that's a very important point. They're all interpenetrate. They depend on each other. They work together as a whole. That something is happening. You know, when we practice meditation, we think about the practice of the breath. We can think of that as a beginner's practice. People often do, because it's what we tend to practice in the beginning of our training. But it's not a beginner's practice in the sense of it's, you know, it's like the kid pool. You know, and then you finally get to dive off the high dive, you know, into the deep end. It's complete unto itself. In the beginning, we don't know that. We can't sort of access that completeness. But it's designed, as it are all of the meditation practices in Buddhism are, to develop the student. And as the student develops, the meditation develops with you. In other words, as we, our capacity develops, our mind settles, our concentration strengthens, our lives begin to transform, the meditation practice has the capacity, will actually evolve with us. It will become more broad. It will become deeper. It's always the same practice, but the way in which, in a way, it opens up to us changes. And we're able to experience that same practice in deeper and deeper ways. So Dongshan comes to Yunmen, clearly committed to the path, answering these simple questions. Why does Yunmen respond this way? An old teacher commenting on this said, Dongshan, being on the finest horse, but alas, he didn't know how to ride it. Shibayama says, standing in front of the White House, he asks for directions to the Capitol. Master Hakuin said, your going and returning takes place nowhere but where you are. So all of the coming and going, the seeking, the getting lost, the returning, all of that takes place nowhere but where we are. He says, your singing and dancing is none other than the voice of the Dharma. The commentary says, after about Master Yunmen's severe blows with a stick, so this was Yunmen's response, and different teachers at this, in these early years of the Chan tradition, were teaching in different ways, employing different skillful means. In a sense, looking back, it might seem that they were experimenting with different ways of trying to actually precipitate a shift, almost to startle the student out of their sort of calcified, stuck ways of being. You know, it's like a moment of insight into anything, but a moment that sort of opens up and we see something for the first time. It's a moment of kind of being startled, right? There's something new that happens in that moment. And so the teachers were using different methods. So some struck, some shouted, some used very powerful language, some used very gentle language. Master Yunmen was famous for using one word or two words, very difficult to grab onto, to understand intellectually. Shibayama says, about Master Yunmen's severe blows, people almost uniformly give the following interpretation. Well, Dongshan's attitude, as seen in his journey, was not earnest enough. And so the strikes of Yunmen's stick were given as moral condemnation of Dongshan for his lazy attitude in training and to inspire him to bestir himself. Shibayama says, they all failed to grasp the real significance of this moment. And that's because they have not themselves experienced it yet. If it were meant as a moral admonition, Master Yunmen would not have taken this up. Master Wumen, who made this collection, would not have taken this up as a koan and asked his disciples to study it, to train in this. It's interesting, in a book that was published recently by Tangen Harada Roshi's students, a more contemporary Japanese master who's part of our own lineage. His teacher, Harada Sagaku Roshi, was very demanding, very strict. And Tangen Harada studied with him. And what he saw after Harada Sagaku died, and he went to take over the abbot's role there, was that the practice had become it was suffering. It had gotten very wobbly. And he felt that his teacher's strictness and the strictness of his discipline had become something that his students were depending upon, had become reliant upon in a way that wasn't helping them. And so when that wasn't there anymore, they kind of got lost. And so in that way, he explained that he started to adapt the training a little bit to help students become more self-reliant. It was still disciplined. It was still, you know, it wasn't a camp picnic. But it was taking away some of those structures or the strictness of it so that students had to rely more on themselves so that they were training and guiding themselves more. However a teacher teaches, their purpose in that is to help the student free themselves. Dogen says, the authentic ancestors of all generations have continued the tradition of face-to-face transmission, studying face-to-face. So we speak of face-to-face interview. Going to meet a teacher, it's face-to-face, it's in person, it's up close. Right? It's always been that way. Because it's not just about what the student says. It's their whole being. They bring their whole being into the room. And sometimes what's clear is what they're saying isn't at odds, is not in alignment with their being. Or what they're saying is not really what's going on. Or what they're saying is only part of what they're able to see at this point. And in that way, it helps the teacher to meet them, right, in face-to-face. Disciple seeing teacher, Dogen said. Teacher seeing disciple. An ancestor, a teacher, or a disciple cannot be a Buddha or an ancestor without this face-to-face. The student meets the teacher. The student meets the Dharma. The student meets themselves. Dogen says, it's like pouring water into the ocean and it spreads endlessly, or transmitting the lamp and allowing that lamp to shine forever. In thousands of millions of transmissions, the trunk and branches are one, breaking an eggshell by pecking from the inside and outside at once. That's pointing to how when an egg is getting ready to hatch, that the hen pecks and the chick taps and eventually the shell breaks. How long this has been happening is beyond comprehension. Quietly and joyously reflect on this. And so he's not just talking about formal transmission. He's talking about the face-to-face exchange, the face-to-face transformation, the face-to-face offering of the teachings that is happening all the time. And so Dongshan has this encounter with Yunmen where he asks these simple questions, Dongshan answers honestly, and then Yunmen says, I give you 60 blows of my stick, sends him away. And then it just says, the next day Dongshan came up and asked the master, yesterday you gave me 60 blows with your stick, what did I do wrong? What was my fault? And there are a lot of dialogues that are like this, that seem to leave out something essential. Shibayama said, Dongshan received 60 blows of the master's stick and retired to his place. He must have felt as if he had been driven into the bottom of a ravine 10,000 feet deep. The koan simply states, the next day Dongshan came and asked the master, where was my fault? I don't know where my fault was. Shibayama says, nothing is mentioned of the intense inner struggle and pain that Dongshan must have had after this encounter with Yunmen until he came to question him the next morning. Consequently, most people seem to overlook this whole spiritual journey that took place during that night, that for Dongshan was of vital importance. It simply shows that they themselves may have never had such an experience. And what he's talking about is the sort of the essence of the seed, of the spark, of the fire that brings forth a spiritual practice. A basic level of discontent. Everything can be okay, and something is not okay. And no matter what we do, no matter how okay our life is, and let's all give a hooray for a good life, right? This isn't about not having a good life. But it's that no matter how good it is, how blessed we may be, if there is a flame within us, there is something that is not at ease. There is something that is not settled. What is this life? Is it just about getting through it? Is it just about getting as much stuff as you can and holding on to it? Is the meaning of our life in what we do, what we accomplish, what we own? This is not a new question. And there are many ways to respond, many of them not so helpful. Where was my fault? Dongshan said. There's a difference between great doubt, wanting to understand. He trusted, he obviously trusted Yunmen. He didn't just think, you know, asshole. You know, I come here all this way to study with you, you treat me like this? Doesn't seem to have occurred to him that way. He thought, this is a teacher, I came to study with him. He asked me these questions, I responded, and he gave me 60 blows. What's happening? What does he want me to see? What is he trying to communicate to me? And so he had faith, he had some faith. And that created this huge inner tension, this doubt about himself, which was the reason he had come to study with Yunmen. And there's a big difference between that doubt, that spiritual doubt, wanting to understand, and self-doubt. What's wrong with me? That wasn't what he was asking. He wasn't thinking, there's something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. Maybe I should just leave, slink out in the middle of the night. I'm not good enough. That wasn't what he was thinking. He was thinking, what am I not seeing? I'm okay, but what is not clear? What does he want me to see? What can I see? And that's very important to understand that distinction. Because in our culture, self-doubt is rather rampant. And I think is part of the manufacturing of our culture. There's a big difference between not yet being clear and knowing that there's something that I don't yet understand, and recognizing that and then concluding there's something wrong with me. And if there's something wrong with me, and I'm thinking that from the point of view of an intrinsic self, of a fixed self, then that means there's something wrong with me that I can't change because it's intrinsic, right? Whereas if there's just something that is not yet clear to me, something I'm not yet seeing, that's a temporary state. And so there's a difference between a temporary state of things and a permanent state of things, right? If we were permanently deluded, then we are completely wasting our time. Practice would be meaningless. There is no practice if there's nothing that can be changed. This is entirely predicated on the fact that everything is change. It's just a question of changing how, for whose benefit. And so that's why these teachings about having great doubt is a positive thing, right? Because when there's something that we really want to understand, there's a lot of energy, a lot of power in that, if it matters. And because we have so many sources of comfort and convenience in our culture, which in a way sort of can distance us and distract us from that deep, essential, and in a sense, very powerful and potentially positive dis-ease, discontent that we may interpret or perceive as something wrong, something painful, something uncomfortable. Yeah, it is. It is uncomfortable. That's the point, in a sense, is to get us to respond. It gets our attention if we'll allow it. And so there's a lot in training that is actually intended not to, you know, not to calm that, but to actually bring it to the surface. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time's passing by. Here we are at the end of another day. Opportunities are lost. And that's not intended to create a state of panic, but a state of wakefulness. so that we actually go to sleep aware, awake. How did I use this day? How can I use this next day if I wake up to one? Whereas our society, our culture would tend to want to just turn us away from that and just into a kind of a semi-state of whatever. And so we can think of Yunmen in this way as expressing his compassion. And I'm sure he had a sense that Dongshan went away not at ease. And he didn't run after him and say, oh, come on, it's okay. You know, let me explain what's going on. He trusted Dongshan. He saw that he was coming here seeking. He saw that he had been traveling, that he had dedicated his life. This was important to him. And he trusted him to be alone with that struggle. That's how much he trusted him. And I remember thinking in moments where I would sit here on my cushion and be in my own hell realm, which would turn to self-pity. I'm miserable, I can't do this, who am I kidding? And secretly I was hoping that somebody was noticing my misery and would come over and put their arms around me and say, it's okay, honey. It's okay. It's going to be all right. Come on. Let's go for a walk. Nobody did that. And even in those early years when I really didn't know what was going on, I interpreted that as trust. I thought, maybe I am trusted. I'm being trusted to sit in this, to have this, to hold this, to inquire into this. That if somebody tried to take it away, that would be a disservice. You know, it's kind of like a piece of fruit hanging from a tree. If it's not ripe, you know, it's hard, it's sour. It's not ready. But in the right conditions, it has a natural capacity to ripen. And in that, its meat becomes sweet and succulent. Think of a peach. Oh, God's food, right? And then at the moment that is right, it drops. And so Dongshan said, where was my fault? What is it that I don't understand? And Yunmen responds with force, you rice bag. Have you been prowling around like this forever? Now south of the lake, next west of the river? Where are you going to go to next? And at that moment, something shifted, something opened up. In that one moment, going here, coming there, seeking this, looking for that, all of that came down to one all-encompassing reality, reaching everywhere, past, present, and future couldn't be found. Before and after, nowhere to be seen. Success and failure, no longer needed. There's a story that a student once came to Master Yunmen and said, what is your essential teaching? And Yunmen said, March 10th. He actually said December 25th, but if it had been today, he'd have said March 10th. He doesn't mean a date on a calendar. What is March 10th when there is nothing apart from that, nothing outside of that, when you are not apart from that? In that one moment, the whole world, the 10,000 things, all of the issues and concerns, the fears and the insecurities dissolved. Dongshan, or rather Yunmen, did not do that to Dongshan. He did not take those things away from him. He did not clear Dongshan's mind. Dongshan did not clear his mind. It wasn't a willful act. It wasn't something he decided to do in that moment. Just like the peach on the tree is not deciding to ripen. It's just its nature. A poem, an old master said, "For years I suffered in snow and frost, and now I'm startled at pussy willows falling." Yunmen held up a mirror, and at that moment, Dongshan was able to see. And the commentary says that Dongshan was immediate lightning. He was not bright enough. It's kind of interesting. In a sense, his searching was over, but his practice and training continued. We live in such an impatient culture. We have no patience for patience. Why does it take so long? When will I get there? Why does it have to be so hard? It isn't hard. Dharma isn't hard. We're what's hard. Our attachments are what's hard. Our held views, our clinging, our, you know. That's what's difficult. That's why we speak of, in the tradition, it talks about nurturing the sacred fetus, that there's a point at the end of training where the student, I remember when I finished training, my teacher was still here, still very actively teaching. And that period of time where I'd finished my training, but I was still able to stay with my teacher and be here, and not yet really take on that role, was one of the most important periods of my whole, not just my training, but my whole life. We call it nurturing the sacred fetus. Being able to continue. And then he says, should Dongshan be struck or not? If you say Dongshan be struck, then everything should be struck. What is he saying? It's not punishment. There's nothing wrong with Dongshan. Dongshan was perfect, like a pearl, like a jewel that came. Yunmen saw that pearl. Dongshan didn't yet see it. And so if Dongshan deserves to be struck, then you got to strike everything. Because everything has that same nature. If he didn't deserve to be struck, then what's going on? David Hinton has a different, another translation of the poem here. He says, "When the lion teaches a cub, it is pure mystery and confusion." Right. When we're actually in training, there's so much that is difficult to see. It's hard to see what's really going on. And in that, it can be confusing. All to herb the cub forward, right? What's the role of the mother, of every mother, of every parent for their child? To raise them so that they can run and fly. When the lion teaches the cub, it's pure mystery and confusion. To urge the cub forward, it leaps away, faints, and tumbles over. In other words, it's sort of one of the images used in Zen is that the teacher pulls the rug out from under the student. What happens when you do that? Well, the student falls. And then they stand up again. They find their ground. Then the teacher pulls the rug out again. And then they fall. They lose their ground, they lose their stability, they stumble, and then they pull the rug out again. Until they pull the rug out and the student doesn't fall. They have understood, they've realized they know how to stand. They always knew how to stand. And part of that is learning how to fall, which is actually a very important part of training. And so when students are given service positions, right? They're rather public, aren't they? They're on the spot, right? And that's just because that's where we're all practicing. But that in that, whatever we do as we are learning, right? There are moments where we stumble. Can we do that? Can we stumble in that moment publicly? I mean, I've made mistakes, still do. I made mistakes that were hugely public. I made mistakes where I thought everybody else was wrong and I was right. And then I realized everybody else was right and I was wrong. All within a matter of moments. Dharma Roshi used to say, mistakes or falling is called learning. What is it when one takes the distant journey? An old master said, if the weather is clear, you can't go. Wait until the rain comes and soaks your head. What did all the ancient holy ones do? They entered the mud. They entered the water. They also went out on good days. But they didn't wait for them. They just went out. And whatever the day was, that's the day. That was March 10th. That was, as Master Yunmen said, a good day. And that's a life transformed, because we no longer have to wait or try and manage the world to get itself into the right conditions. We live in a time of samsara. That's always been happening. It's not likely to go away any day soon. And so to find our peace, we have to find our peace in the world that we're in the life that we're in. And the Buddha said, each of us is completely capable of that. We were born with that pearl. But just like the dragon at the front door, it's clutching it in its claws, and you got to deal with that to get the pearl. The pearl is you. The dragon is you. Is that good news or bad news? In the beginning, it seems mostly bad. Could you just put the pearl down, please? But we come to see it's good news, because you don't have to wait. You don't have to ask somebody to do that for you. It's like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly. How long has this been happening? How long this has been happening is beyond comprehension. And then Dogen says, quietly and joyously reflect on this. This is our inheritance. Not just the Buddhist path, but Buddha nature. That in every time, in every generation, in every birth, in every human being, there is a pearl. And there's a lot of poetic language and teachings around that in Buddhism. And that's nice. But it's pointing at a real truth. And that's the basis of our practice, is uncovering that pearl. That's what this whole weekend is about. That's what this morning is about. If you practice meditation within the Buddhist tradition, that's what you're doing in your meditation. That's what's actually happening in your meditation, if you're practicing sincerely, even when you don't know it. That's how powerful and already present that pearl is, that when we're practicing, it's already functioning in ways beyond our capacity to know and see. So let us quietly and joyously reflect on this.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.